Documentaries.
Uh-huh.
History. Insights. Interviews. Chef's Deep Dive.
And welcome to Chef's Deep Dive. And this time we've got our guest. He's all the way back. He's the man with the knowledge, my friend Simon Gough.
We've taken all you give. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, the pity on working man. We ain't asking you to love us. You may place yourself high above us. Mr. President,
Bifford, hello mate, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, the man with the knowledge. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. I'm all the way back. Sitting at the back in the cinema, traditionally one of the best seats in the house, if I remember some of those good times back in the day.
Yeah.
I just liked all the way back. That should be my campaign slogan.
All the way back.
Got my head full of elections and campaigns and stuff now, politics.
Oh, right. Your head's all ready for the new Trump. Trump gets re-elected again.
whoa, steady. Who's listening to this after the 2020 presidential election? Yeah, at this point, we still thought Trump might lose. Moving on.
We'll see what happens there. And it's funny you should talk about presidential elections, because we're all today to go through the 1976 film All President's Men.
Redford.
I'm Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Mr. Markham, are you here in connection with the Watergate burglary?
I'm not here.
Hoffman.
Hi, this is Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, and I was just wondering if you can remember...
All the President's Men. The story of the two young reporters who cracked the Watergate conspiracy.
You very kindly gave me the choice of films to talk about. And this is a film that I've enjoyed for a long time. I watched it first years ago. Captivating film. And I've always been fond of it. One of those films that makes you feel like a grown-up when you watch it, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Much like the moment when you decide that you actually quite like eating olives, I think.
Yeah, I train myself to eat olives. Didn't want to miss out.
First impression, why are you going to eat that? It looks like rabbit shit. Several occasions, normally, where you go, it tastes like rabbit shit. Well, no, I don't know what rabbit shit actually tastes like, but... So, why have I got to do this? Whose idea was this? Bloody Italians? Greeks? What's going on? And then eventually, slowly, and then you go, do you know what? These are nice, and it makes you feel like a grown-up and sophisticated.
Yeah.
This film's a bit like that. So, on the face of it, you might think slightly dry subject matter, and it's old. It's like well old, Rob. Prehistoric, right?
Came out the same year I was born.
Well, quite.
And do you not find as well that the making of it, it's only, 3 years after the collapse of Tricky Dicky? It's like, it's just gone, Robert Redford's gone, fucking hell, I'm having a bit of this. Get on this now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah.
Redford apparently went and optioned the book, basically puts a marker down and says, I want the film rights to this. In 74. So, spent 2 years putting the production together, and then the film came out in 76. So, I was thinking, like, wow, is there a similar sort of scenario in the modern day where stuff's come out in that sort of time frame?
I couldn't think of one. I had the same idea.
There will be things. I think, ironically, sometimes it's slightly more gung-ho action-y shit, like Black Hawk Down or...
Yeah.
Or, you know, the one that was about the contractors in Libya that had John Krasinski in it.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, basically this it came out. And actually, if you look into it a little bit, the production, especially Redford, talk about the fact that they really wanted to be in there, kind of reflecting the world as it was, as the story was still unfolding, and
yeah,
it felt like it was such an important thing that they wanted to tell that story. He's that level. He's that famous. Bought the book and then went and found a screenwriter. Picked a not bad one, William Goldman. If you ever read his book, by the way, I can't remember the bloody name of it, but I've got it somewhere. It's
he did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid as well, didn't he?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I feel like I should know that. I have read the book. So Goldman's top class.
Yeah.
When he's a screenwriter. Then he starts looking for a co-star, lands on Dustin Hoffman. Then he lands on a director, Alan J. Pakula.
Yeah.
And
he was going to have Al Pacino, wasn't he, in his sights at first.
It's a good example of where actually I could see Pacino doing it. Although he does have a nasty habit of running into the toilets and grabbing a gun, Al Pacino. So I think they'd probably have had to have cut that. Plus,
yeah.
You can't really go around shooting people if you're a reporter. That's not really how it works.
He was in a bit of his heyday in the 70s, wasn't he, Al?
Keeler brought on a guy called Gordon Willis, who's a cinematographer who he'd worked with before, but also did Godfather. If you think about the cinematography in that film, which is completely outstanding.
Also, just to jump on the back on the cinematography of it, it's probably one of the only films which really uses a foreground and background look. Like, to do that as a look, where it shows a lot of when he's picking up the phone and you see all the action in the background, which is unusual. I think for modern day listeners, Quentin Tarantino uses that quite often, using to see what's going in the background or someone's doing in the foreground. Also, the sound of this film. A lot of parts of the sound of this film is silent, and all you're hearing is the humdrum of the daily activities in the office. There's very little music accompanying it.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it starts right at the beginning. You're so right to mention that, some of the sound effects as well. So, opening shot, what you think are gunshots, but it's the keys of a typewriter. Cut to completely black screen, some very faint noises. Suddenly you get a light, and you realise it's some guys creeping around in a dark building with torches.
Yeah.
Spellbinding opening sequence where these guys are clearly up to no good, let's be clear. And ironically, they've got masks and surgical gloves on, which we've been told these days is a good thing.
Yeah.
in topical reference there, listeners. In those days, you know, but we're basically, and they're all suited.
I thought that. Why are they all suited? But probably maybe if they're walking around offices, they could just blag it, couldn't they?
Well, I think there's a little bit of everybody wore a suit then. It was the olden days.
Yeah.
Also, I think actually you've been shown some guys who are pros. You've been shown guys that are financed, and this isn't some kind of, you know, smackhead, breaking a window sort of a serious job, right?
Definitely.
So, and this is where I don't know if we need to, if we're going to roll into talking through the plot.
Let's talk about in general, just go for it, enjoy it.
But I think you see that opening sequence, some beautiful shots. There's a stunning shot where you're looking across the road down to the building and two of the rooms have got lights on.
Yeah.
When you're reading about it, effectively they had a sentry. They'd taken a room in a building across the road whose specific job was, well, they could stick a sentry in there who could keep them appraised of what was going on. Said sentry apparently fell asleep, didn't notice the police turn up, and only told them that the police were in the building
when there was in.
When they were sort of far too late to get away. These guys, turns out they were in the CIA, three of them. Yeah, these are literally people who've been engaged by the security services, by the spies,
yeah.
You know, or their operatives, whatever you want to call them. But not capable of something as basic as actually doing their job. They get nicked. It's been treated as a local news story. So it's gone through the local news desk on the paper. Bob Woodward gets sent to the courthouse to go and find out what's going on.
I think right at the beginning, with those guys coming through into the court, that's where you get that they're going to play with the noise. Because when he goes, who do you work for? And he goes, CIA. He goes, no, who do you work for? The criminal investigation department. And then that's his ears pricked up and thinks, ooh, got a story here.
Well, I mean, the scenes in the courthouse are beautiful because Woodward rocks up and he says, yeah, who's representing these burglar guys? And they somebody just sort of idly says to him, oh, well, nobody, to be honest. They've got their own lawyers. Right, Woodward at this point goes, yeah? Burglars don't bring their own legal representation, you know, clearly. So what's going on? So his ears prick up at that point.
Yeah.
And then he starts sniffing around and then he spots this lovely, and there's a great little reference, some country club guy. He immediately like, oh, okay, so there's some money involved, right? Politely introduces himself to this lawyer and the lawyer immediately gives it away by saying, I'm not here. Yeah, what can I ask what you're doing here? I'm not here.
To be honest, at that point, he could have played it a hell of a lot better and maybe would have not brushed off Robert Redford's actor. But, you know what I mean? He plays it cocky. Like, yeah, I'm not really here. Yeah.
I think this is a key point and it's something that you have to bear in mind, I think, winding the clock back. And also you get this sense, frankly, that it's probably true in America now and it's probably still true here. People in those kind of worlds who move in those circles think that they're entitled to make the rules up as they go along. So he's effectively saying, I'm too important to worry about the likes of you, dickhead.
Yeah.
Run along, because this is big boy stuff that we're doing here. You need to toddle off. I watched the film earlier on with on a Blu-ray, and I watched one of the extras, and there was a reference to the fact that Woodward at the time apparently was the lowest paid reporter on the whole paper.
So I just get the dog job. So going to the court is just hunting for a better story, isn't it?
What they're trying to do, and Redford talks about how important it was to him that people realised what journalism involved.
Yeah.
In terms of the reality of the job. A shitload of their job was very, very routine stuff. Local news desk, local reporter. You're attending court cases. You're interviewing people after events have occurred. You're turning up at accidents. You're turning up at public meetings, you're turning up at all sorts of things where your job literally is just to gather, and 99 times out of 100, it just becomes run-of-the-mill, bog-standard story, bog-standard reporting. But the point, some of the little things that they do, like he introduces himself at the beginning, I'm Bob Woodward from the Washington Post. That's a basic thing. You can't use anything you say to somebody if you haven't already told them that you're a reporter. And you know, it's those little things, and I just love that scene because of the way that it cuts from, they have the conversation, he goes, I'm not here, and then Woodward follows him to the drinks and then follows him back to his seat and won't let him go, and you're like, okay, this dude's like,
it's a bit of a bulldog, he's got his teeth into something,
yeah, a terrier maybe, like he's not you know, just, you know, subtle difference in terms of dogs, but like you say, dogged and consistent, and he's just trying to professionally work it through. And then he sits there and goes, hang on, how the fuck did this guy even know to come down here? Because it turns out that they've already checked that the guys, when they were nicked, hadn't rung anybody, they hadn't contacted anybody, right?
Yeah.
So even at this stage, like, I mean, I've seen the film loads of times, so I noticed this finally, but I mean, not sure you'd necessarily pick up on it first time you see it, but fundamentally, it's like, hang on, somebody else must have been on the other end of the walkie-talkies then. Must have called the lawyer, right? Again, you sort of say, well, why don't we cut them off? Why did we send a lawyer down there then? But they were hoping to just swan in, relying on all the people in court to just not think twice that these guys were doing it.
Yeah.
And it would have gone away, right? So, yeah, it's a great opener, because he comes back in to the paper and you meet the editors and start to sort of get some sort of insight into the way that how the editorial process works a little bit. Famously, they built a set to replicate the office of the paper, because the paper wouldn't let them film in the real office. You know, they famously really minutely copied the details from the original building.
Because what I got from this is, because this is just a short time after this had happened, majority of the people they're portraying in the film in that office possibly would have been still working, you know what I mean? Especially like Harry Rosenfield, one of the main, you know what I mean, the man who pushes him on.
Ben Bradley was still the editor of the Washington Post when the film came out. Yeah, and the other two key editor characters that are both really good characters and really well played. Although apparently the guy, Howard Simons, was quite resentful of the production. He didn't think his role in it got enough coverage in the film, and he was upset. So
that's not the body of the film, though, is it? That's not what they're trying to say.
He's been in one more fucking film than I have. Anyway, sorry. Lovely bloke, I'm sure. But no, it's interesting though. Well, apparently they approached Bradley and said, "Can we film at the office?" Like, expecting him to be like, "Yeah, go for it."
Yeah.
And he was like, "No, you idiots! I've got to run a newspaper, right?" So they were like, "Oh yeah, shit, sorry." So they apparently spent the equivalent of millions building a effectively a complete replica. There's one scene that I've always loved, and I watched the film again obviously today, and it was sort of like, yeah, man, this is still such a good scene. The first time they've got a really good story, that's a solid story. I think it's where they've effectively established that you can link the money that was spent on the burglars,
yeah,
to the campaign to re-elect, and you can sort of see that there's a direct financial involvement.
Yeah. Is it where they get that check for 25k?
So effectively, one of the burglars has got some money in his bank account, and one of the payments in, this is in the good old days when it was bits of paper that they literally photocopied and
yeah,
the bank's records were on paper, but there's a receipt into his bank account for $25,000. And that is in the form of a cashier's check for a fundraiser from the Republican committee to re-elect the president. So, how the fuck's that got there, right? So they know they've got a story now, and so they come into the editorial conference, and you've got this scene where the editor of the paper's sitting there going, "All right, guys," and they're running through the day's stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have the foreign editor. They don't mention sport, a bit of a distraction. Although I'd have been quite interested, you know. Although it would have been American sports, actually, that's what she is. Baseball. Is that a sport? I don't think so.
It's rounders.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's an excuse to eat fucking hot dogs, is what it is. No offence, America. But, it's no cricket, let's be clear. Anything you can finish in 3 hours? No. It goes round. So foreign editor, then you go national news, and there's been a little bit of beef where national guys are going, "We're covering this, it's a national story." And the obvious retort is, "Well, if you guys hadn't been asleep, maybe we'd have known that the president was a crook, right?" Yeah. Anyway, we don't know that yet. And then it comes to Howard Warden's character. He's really pushing for this story to get, you know, somewhere towards the front page of the paper. Anyway, they all agree it. And then a parting shot, the foreign desk guy goes, "Oh man, I can't believe we're doing this Watergate thing." One of the other guys says, yeah, I'm getting people coming up to me now from the White House going, "What are you lot on about? What are you doing?" And the guy just goes, "Look, I think it's dangerous for the paper. Why is nobody else doing this?" It's the sort of thing I'd say, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
why is nobody else covering this? Why is it just us? Like, is this really what... is the President of the United States really going to do this shit, right? And it's crazy. And everybody's sort of like... But you can see, he's making a really sensible case for... Why the hell are we doing this? And Bradley just sits back and goes, and it's sort of, you can tell it's a real decision point for him. He's just gone, "Fuck it, let's have a go," right? You know, he's thinking this will be the story that makes this newspaper a force. This could sort us out for the next 20 years. The bravery of Bradley to follow through with it and just go, "Fuck this," and the proprietress of the paper.
Yeah.
Publisher being prepared to back them, you know, they followed it for a year at least, where there was them, the New York Times were reporting it as well, but from a slightly different angle, and yeah, nobody else, no, like the guy says in the film, nobody else is picking this up. There's five reporters. He says something like, "There's 2,000 reporters in this town, and maybe five of them are on this."
Yeah,
you know, why are we doing it? And. Yeah, that's a superb scene. Just makes you realise what a big picture it is. And
but it's similar to say, like, now, do you get this hunt and drive to find these, corruptions, what are going on? Or are people, because of the internet, there's tons of made up, like you said, there's tons of conspiracies, and everyone now could be a reporter. Anyone could start a Twitter account and say something a little bit scandalous, and then it's not necessarily going to be looked into. Have we come numb to the fact that there is corruption anyway, and we're just like, oh yeah, it's just that again. You know what I mean? See, think about it since then until now, what's happened.
Yeah, it is different. The thing for me, though, frankly, is that I don't think the sponsorship is there to go look for the stories. I think different. I think the desire to educate and inform, well, inform and educate, maybe, has been overtaken by we're trying to sell stuff to people.
Can you imagine now, have you, say you and I was the, you know, Carl and Bob, yeah? Can you imagine now the editor saying, oh yeah, we'll still run for it. We'll still look at it within a year. They're still going at it in a year. Now it's more like takeaway. It's like, have you done that? No, right, just move on. Just go find something else.
Yeah, if there wasn't an easy and cheap way to get the news, then it wouldn't be happening. And I think that's the thing. That's why this film has got the power it has and the opportunity, you know, to remind people that the press, the free press, is such an important part of a democracy. And
yeah. Yeah,
it's one of the reasons why I think it's got a real role to play as shining a light on things, and why I thought it was a good idea to, you know, why it's a good one to pick out and talk about in these modern times.
Most definitely. Can you clear something up for me, right? How is it? How did Bob get the deep throat attached to him? Was that through doing some work beforehand or something? Because it didn't really explain that.
Apparently, they'd met. They'd met some years before. There's a reference in the film, a passing reference in the dialogue to George Wallace, and yeah. We're led to infer from that that... So George Wallace was a presidential candidate in the 60s who was shot. We imagine that Deep Throat gave Woodward some
info there.
Information on that. But apparently they met sometime before, in the late 60s, and they'd stayed in touch. And so it's interesting, this, because obviously nowadays, if you watch the film,
yeah,
and you are new to it and you do what a lot of people do now and they Google shit,
yeah,
you'll find the reference to Deep Throat and you'll be told who Deep Throat was.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was made public. But at the time, when they made the film, nobody knew who Deep Throat was.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Woodward scrupulously never gave away who it was. And what happened was the guy was actually the deputy director of the FBI. He's a bloke called Mark Felt. And he'd been in the FBI since the war, more or less, since just after the war. And he resigned from the FBI in 1973. And actually, that created some speculation even then. And certainly, it dogged him for the rest of his days that he was Deep Throat. His name was often put forward because people had noticed that it was never confirmed until Felt confirmed it himself, which I believe was in 2003 or something like that. So
wow! So all that time.
Yeah. So Woodward never said who it was. Bradley knew who it was. Bernstein knew who it was, but a handful of others. But effectively, they kept that secret. But yeah, the what you'd read from it is that the FBI guy was so dismayed with what he was seeing,
yeah,
so sick of it, that he decided to just, you know, spill the beans and whistleblow because he couldn't cope with how fucked it was. And so having a reporter that he could go to was probably something that he'd thought, well, I might as well cultivate,
yeah,
a couple of contacts so that I can release stuff if I see fit.
Yeah, like sort of like a very early WikiLeaks, really.
Yeah, well, I think... those sort of roles, those sort of people would have always had reporters that they could call on. That's not an uncommon thing. Yeah, he basically obviously wanted to make sure that the administration in the White House didn't get away with it. I mean, there's a really scary thread where the first thing that Nixon's advisors said to him when the burglary got discovered,
yeah,
was, well, we'll contact somebody in the CIA and tell them to tell the FBI to leave it alone.
Wow. How powerful do you have to be for that?
So we'll use our supposed foreign intelligence service.
Yeah.
Instruct our domestic federal crime service.
Shut up.
You know, that's like, that is the equivalent of James Bond being told to go and have a word with fucking Dixon and Doc Green. But yeah, Felt was an interesting guy. Like I said, he'd been with the FBI since the 40s. But, don't forget, Hoover, who was the director of the FBI, had also...
Oh, God, yeah.
Since since before the war.
Yeah,
so this
yeah.
is a guy that this is a guy that's run the FBI for 60 years or something at that stage. Well, no, not 60. That's ridiculous. It's the early 70s. 40 years. So there's lots of this as well. Most of these guys had fought in the war, right? Not Woodward and Bernstein. They were too young.
Yeah.
An American man who was 50
yeah.
would have fought in the war.
Yeah.
Got out of it, right? These guys had a different view of who they were, you know, than we do. They fought for their country. They fought to defend their way of life. They I think people from that generation felt it more than we do, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the American political scene at that time was fucking mental as well. You know, if you look at Nixon, I mean, I started reading a bit about Nixon just to sort of, because everybody's heard of some, you know, some obvious things, but like looking at a little bit of where he'd come from, what his political background was and so on. And I mean, incredible, really. Like, genuinely, like, really? His whole career was based on being anti-communist.
Right.
So he'd first got into politics on a ticket of Reds Under the Bed, basically.
Is that like the 50s at that time? When he had that... He more or less pushed it out there to Hollywood, and it was all over the news and stuff.
He got elected to Congress in the late 40s.
Yeah.
As a congressman, and then he became a senator. No, let me get this right. He stood down, and then he was elected to be the vice president under Eisenhower.
Wow.
In 52. So this is really interesting. I hadn't really realised this, but so he was really young to be a vice president. He was 30.
Yeah, yeah.
When he got into that post. Eisenhower was much older.
Yeah.
And obviously he was a war hero. He was ill, apparently, Eisenhower, a couple of times in his presidency for weeks on end. He had a stroke. Nixon stepped up.
What, like Clinton had a stroke? Hey!
So, really interesting, though. Eisenhower basically campaigned on I'm going to change everything. And Nixon came in and started slating the opponent and digging him out. He got his nickname Tricky Dicky from that time in the 40s and 50s when he was first campaigning and first becoming famous as a politician.
Oh, I never knew that. I thought it was from this scandal that he got it from.
He was notorious by the time he was vice president for being the guy that was going to dig out his opponent and find the weakness and basically say, you can't have this guy, you need me instead.
Yeah, yeah.
And then basically after Eisenhower had to stand down, they knew Kennedy would win, so that he didn't try and even go for being president.
Yeah.
No, actually, I think he might have stood against Kennedy in 1960, but then he gave up after that for the rest of the 60s. That was it. So he stood in 60 as the presidential candidate, lost. Kennedy got in. When Kennedy was assassinated, because you can tell he was a canny bloke, Nixon just went, fuck, we ain't got a chance now for the rest of the decade, have we?
Yeah.
So he deliberately sat back, and then in 68, kind of came forward again and said, yeah, I'll stand. Only just won. Very, very close election.
Oh, right.
The other thing that's interesting about him, I think, is that he was apparently much more interested in foreign policy than he was in domestic stuff. So he was actually quite inert domestically. He didn't really engage the American public that much. He was more interested in, obviously, Vietnam and what they were doing in Vietnam.
So why was that then? Because the America wasn't rich at that point. So why would he decide to make a name for himself internationally, more against the other powers?
It was about the way I'd look at it, and this is, people are probably like take me to town for like oversimplifying, but fundamentally you've got a choice in that situation, right? In the world, the Americans believe their role is to keep the world safe, right?
Yeah.
So they view the Russians and the Chinese as a massive threat.
Yeah.
And so they're active in the rest of the world saying, we are going to step in and make sure that you guys don't take over because we think you're wrong-uns.
Yeah.
So hence they go to Korea and they manage to keep the Chinese out of Korea.
Yeah.
And then they get involved in Vietnam, right? They've got no idea what they're doing. So they've been in Vietnam for 10 years. They've spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on it. Thousands of their lads are getting killed.
Really, really bad press as well.
Everybody in America is basically like, why the fuck are we still doing this?
Yeah.
By 68, 69, they're all desperate to come out.
Yeah.
Johnson, the president, Lyndon Johnson, had basically tried to... His election campaign in 68 was, I'll get us out of Vietnam, basically. and so was Nixon's. So that's what they committed to do.
Yeah.
Domestically, America was very prosperous.
Yeah.
But the biggest issue clearly was race.
Right.
And the Republicans weren't remotely interested in race because they were more interested in money. So they didn't give a fuck about what happened to the black people in America. The Democrats had basically gone, well, our thing is people.
Yeah.
We'll win elections by getting black people to vote for us.
Right. Right.
So by the late '60s, you know, Martin Luther King.
Yeah, Malcolm X. Yeah.
Race riots throughout Northern America. You know, the famous ones, Detroit, Bay, right. So Republicans are like, not interested. Yeah, whatevs.
Yeah.
Democrats are like, this is a big deal, and a lot of white Americans were just like, I don't want to think about this. What I am worried about is the fact that my son might get drafted.
Yeah, yeah.
And not come back from Vietnam, right? So politically, the leaders had to look at that and go, well, a Republican, he's got nothing to gain from civil rights because they're Democrat voters.
Yeah, yeah.
So if Republicans just interested in the economy and something that might get him kicked out, well, something that might get him kicked out is Vietnam.
Right.
So when Nixon comes in, his focus is I need to get us out of Vietnam because that's the only way I'll stay in, right? When you look at it, by 72, I mean, he won with a landslide. It's one of the biggest election victories they've ever had.
Yeah.
The Democrats fell to pieces. And although it turns out that one of the reasons why that happened was because the Republicans were in the middle of it pulling all sorts of dirty tricks.
Dirty trick, yeah.
Right, but, you know, he was tricky. but yeah, it's really interesting because it paints a picture of him as somebody that just wants to, you know, basically keep the lights on. Because now he's there. It's like, I'm here now. I've done it.
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't actually want to make life better for anyone. He didn't actually want to do anything for America, is the way people look at it now in hindsight and go, you know, and the way he treated being a president, as in, you know, because one thing that came out, it's after the film finishes, but through the 73, 74, 75 is the so-called tapes.
Yeah, he was the first to put those tapes in the office when he recorded everything. We more or less bugged everyone else.
Absolutely, yeah. And the picture it painted when that all came out a couple of years later, that how do we respect this guy? He's a little bitch, basically.
Yeah.
And also, he was a really shitty guy when it came to actually how he treated people. He used to swear all the time. He was always shouting at people. He was always swearing. He was always moaning. And he just didn't care. He didn't care about the rules. He was just doing what he wanted. Yeah. Nixon was a watershed for them because they've never had to kick a president out of office before.
No.
It profoundly shocked them as a nation. They spent years getting over it. Reagan came in, and Reagan was the guy that made the office again,
yeah.
I think. And
but he mainly had the immense backing of the FBI then, who was Bush, wasn't it?
Also, Reagan was a puppet. I mean, he was just a...
Yeah, he was just a face because it was like, everyone knows you, or we need someone.
Yeah, people trusted him. Ironically, when you look at Nixon now, a lot of his achievement, well, a lot of things that you might call his achievements were quite long-lasting things. He was the first guy to... He actually formally got them in kind of diplomatic engagement with China.
Yeah, and Russia as well.
Well, he signed the first anti-nuclear missile,
yeah,
or missile control treaties with the Russians. Nixon. Well, I mean, this Nixon was bugging his phone calls with our prime minister. So
it's funny because it was only about 5 years back, wasn't it, that they found out that the British was bugging the Germans or something like that, or we was bugging someone else and. It still happens now.
Potentially, you're not really doing your job properly if you're not recording the phone calls that the Prime Minister makes. So you get the feeling that sort of thing probably ought to be recorded. But anyway, I'm just thinking, like, I made quite a few notes for this film.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some good lines. Robards gets some great lines, doesn't he? So
yeah,
I wrote one quote down because I thought this is a good Hollywood line. He's got the two guys in his office, and they're basically, he's like, I need a better story, fucking come on. And they're like, we just haven't had any luck.
Oh yeah.
And he just goes, get some.
Yeah. But the look he gives Woodward at that time, it was like he could have just cut him in half.
Bradley didn't want Rovards. He'd apparently said to Robert Redford that he wanted a different actor. Forget who it was now. George T. Scott. There he goes. Who played Patton? He's got that line. There's another line. Like, you know, some of the more famous ones. You know, like the one when he's in his dressing gown on his front lawn.
Oh yeah.
It's the First Amendment. You know, the country and maybe the whole history of this nation. But
it's brilliant. And then he turns around to him and goes, "Well, get on, have a bath for 15 minutes, and get back to it." And then he just walks off.
I think the point of mentioning that to some extent is that the film, you know, we've spiraled off there into a conversation about American politics, Nixon's legacy, and you get some real, you get to some very big picture themes.
Yeah.
This film, clearly, right? But the actual filmmaking craft in it is superb.
Yeah.
There's the way that they give the guy some killer lines, you know, trailer moments, you call them, wouldn't you? You know, there's a scene quite near the beginning which I love. I noticed it again this morning and thought, like, fuck, that is so good the way he does it. When they hear on the phone that it's quite near the beginning. Hunt, who's one of the, effectively, is one of the operatives, who's working for Creep. They ring up the librarian at the White House, don't they? She says, "Oh yeah, no, I remember him. I can't remember the books he wanted though. Hold on a minute, I'll just go and find what he was after."
Yeah.
Back and goes, "Oh no, I was mistaken. Sorry. He didn't request any books. I mean, I don't know what books he wanted. I mean, he didn't request any. I mean, I don't know who he is. I've never heard of him."
Yeah, she might as well have said, "Where am I? I don't know who this is. Goodbye."
Her boss rings them a minute later and goes, "Just want to clarify that she denies speaking to your reporter." They go, "Well, fuck off." Right? The two of them go, and this scene is in the film to show you the reporter's craft and their dogged determination, right?
Yeah.
They're like, "Well, if somebody's been to a library, that'll be on record."
Yeah.
It's all public stuff. So they go down to this library, and you get this really lovely office with a high ceiling and an elaborate kind of, decor, and you get a bloke, a white guy, looks quite officious, sat at a desk, who really smugly says, those are transactions are private.
Yeah.
Off you pop, boys.
Yeah.
Cut to, black guy, kind of bit of an afro, bit of facial hair, tie, kind of like much more dusty, fusty, kind of a little sort of bunker somewhere.
Yeah.
You're wearing a cubbyhole. And you immediately, I don't think the racial thing is important in it, but it's the contrast of setting. You've got establishment and some guy, like, who might be a little bit more of a rebel.
Yeah.
Just from the appearance, and he just goes, yeah, I can show you whatever, because and what they're saying is sort of like, A, they've gone and looked in a few places, they've not just taken the first knock back and gone, oh shit, never mind, and gone home, so they've plugged away, but also, if you play the system and you know the way it works, then you'll find a way in.
Yeah.
It's almost paying homage to the American public, the federal government, in the sense that it's our privilege that as citizens, that our taxes to some extent go to this. Any member of the public could go and do that, right? They happen to be reporters, they know it's there, they've got access to it, but like, effectively it's saying, these are our institutions, these belong to you. You could have come and asked for this.
Yeah.
The book of records, they get the book of tickets.
Oh, and then it does one of the most beautiful shots in the film, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So you see these two guys at a desk, thumbing through, and then it cut to, oh, hang on, and they're in some big room, and there's other people there.
Yeah.
One more cut, and all of a sudden it's from the dome, and the It's the Congressional Library, I think.
Yeah. So it goes right to the top and you can see how huge it is. So more or less emphasize how huge a task of what it is they're performing.
Also, I think, as if to say, as the viewer, you know, certainly if you're an American, you should be proud that this belongs to you.
Yeah.
And that this is there for you. And that these guys have gone in there.
It's very much which not a lot of people use at all, but it's freely available. It's the public domain services. Anyone can ask for majority of things off in Parliament, and you know what's been told in Parliament, even going back to many years, and then there's certain records which become open in public domain. Like there's always the case of, will they open the records for JFK? And I think that time has gone, and then they've classified it again, or reclassified it again. You know what I mean? There's so much in the public domain, but it's not really taught. It's not really told you. It's like, we've got it, we'll just keep quiet.
You're not necessarily encouraged to go and find these things. And I think that scene is like, in the film, is sort of, is to show you that you can't portray that. That's got more power and more resonance than...
Yeah.
Than one individual president or one individual administration, you know.
I wonder how much this film, because watching it for me is quite inspiring. Can you imagine watching this in 1976, and maybe you was at the age of around 18 or something? You'd feel like you want to get involved with news reporting. I wonder how much people was inspired by this to go and go, you know, I could fucking do that. This is something for the country.
I saw a line earlier on. Where they were saying like the number of applications to do journalism, like thousands of people wanted to do it, and I think, like I said, I mean it made the Washington Post or it consolidated the Washington Post, you know, and it made the careers of those two reporters as well. I mean, they've to some extent never stopped talking about it since.
It must get paid every time they do then.
Yeah. You do something like that, you've probably never really got to work again after that.
No.
They've both published plenty of books since, I think.
Yeah, of ideas, and then they can just give lectures for a shitload of money, can't they? I suppose that's where one of the other things that they can get.
The other thing to mention about the film is just, like, in terms of Pakula, the director, and the style and the mood.
Yeah.
I think you touched on it before, but it does have lots of long shots, lots of really distant...
I like those shots, yeah.
And there's a couple of times when Redford's coming out of the car park.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, the sound effects in the car park, the fact that, you know, stone...
Yeah, to drop.
...noise, and he jumps. And there's a classic Hollywood. He turns around because the car screeches its tyres, turns around and then deep throat's gone. Yeah,
And then he sort of shits it a bit, doesn't he? He panics and he runs out. No one's following him, but he feels that following. And also, from a few of the shots, I don't know if you noticed as well, was travelling but keeping the audio of them in the car. So there's a few where it shows more or less the complicated journey and the streets within Washington. So the car sets off and then it suddenly pulls out to you see the grid of the streets. But you're hearing them still in the car, more or less to say that they're on a constant journey to try and find and investigate this.
And all of a sudden it's like these two little ants.
Yeah, exactly.
They're ants in the ant's nest. Like, there's a bit, you know, in the note he gets from Deep Throat right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he gets his paper one morning and this note falls out of the paper. And instantly you're like, where the fuck have they done that? He reads the note and the note says... take precautions against being followed.
Yeah.
And you see him, gets a taxi, pulls up outside the opera house, just as everybody's coming out, gets out of the taxi, walks into the middle of the crowd, and turns around, walks out of the crowd, gets in another taxi, and you're like, shit, man.
It's really clever, really clever.
I mean, if they were following him, I did think this, if they were following him, then it's like, what's he done? Oh, he's got out of the taxi, where's he gone? In there somewhere. Oh, look, there he is.
Yeah, it doesn't make himself conspicuous by wearing, what is it, a mustard-coloured suit all the time, which you can just spot a mile away.
I was quite inspired. First time I watched it, I was like, yeah, man, cords. I wore cords for a bit after that. The bit that I think is, like, from a psychological point of view, is brilliant is that last time when he comes out of the garage and he's jumpy. And you know it's like, I think that's the one where he overslept, so you know it's late.
Yeah.
And it cuts to him, and it's dawn, and he's walking through this empty square.
Yeah.
And you know that he's basically walked home, because he's that fucking sort of paranoid that he doesn't want to use any kind of transport. And it's all of a sudden he's like, shit, like, I can't get, there's no metro, I'm not going to get on a bus, I'm not going to get a taxi, they could...
Yeah.
The only person now I can trust is me.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to hear it coming, I want to be able to see it coming, so I'm just going to walk. And I don't care if it takes me 2 hours and my feet hurt, I'm just going to walk home.
At that part of the film as well, so three quarters of the way through the movie then, he's overslept, he's had a lot of pressure on him, he's got extreme stress from his editor. And at that point, he still has respect for Deep Throat, but he's sort of had enough as well. The way he turns around to me and goes, stop with this more or less chicken shit. You know, fucking tell me. You know what I mean? I don't want to play games anymore. And at that point, you can see Deep Throat had an option. He could have just gone back into the shadows and disappeared. But you can see he gets a bit disturbed himself, like to think, you know what, he's right. I'll fucking tell him. If not, this is going to go down. It's not going to work. Or then things, what he wants happening and he's playing that game, isn't going to happen. So then he gives him more information, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at it in terms of the real individuals, it doesn't necessarily come across in the film, but Deep Throat was quite an old man by then.
Yeah.
He was in his 60s, I think. Whereas Woodward was like still under 30. So I think there would have been an element of, you know, trying to guide and trying to influence and trying to steer. I'm not going to spoon feed the kid.
Yeah.
But by that stage,
he was frustrated. He could have just lost it.
Yeah, I mean, it was looking perhaps like the administration was going to be able to close around this and make it go away.
Yeah.
In hindsight, it doesn't come out in the film. In the film, it's quite clever the way that they finish the film off as well, because the last scene with actors in it is Woodward and Bernstein both at their desk typing.
Yeah.
Nixon's, what's the word?
Congregation. Inauguration, yeah. And again, he's using that way to look in the foreground and background.
They call it deep focus in the blurb. It cuts straight from them typing like that, because they're feeling like, shit, we can write the story now. It cuts to the various different bulletins of as the dominoes start to fall and different folks start getting indicted and whatever. Apparently, nobody's ever fully spelled out why they broke into Watergate in the first place.
Yeah, that's one of the questions I've got to ask you. It's like, why was there in there? And why did they have so many?
Well, potentially that's just about slightly overmanned because they've almost got too much money. So it's almost like they've rocked up like to do it that way because they're swimming in money, so why not? Why not just take loads of guys? Two dominant theories about why they were there.
Yeah.
One is that they were, this is the more official inverted commas theory, it's that they were trying to bug a Democratic party official.
Yeah.
The other theory is that they were looking for evidence of Democrats being involved in dodgy stuff, so they were searching the offices rather than trying to plant bugs.
Oh, right.
But fundamentally, they were caught with loads of bugging equipment.
Yeah, and photography equipment as well.
Most people feel that they were there trying to bug them just because... And it kind of comes back to Nixon being so completely paranoid and all of his people around him being so paranoid that they genuinely would spend thousands and thousands of taxpayers' dollars on bugging people just in case and keeping all these people under surveillance just in case. And you know, you get this real sense of like how bloated it all was and sort of how much money was washing around.
But that paranoia goes downhill, does it? So if the top man is paranoid, it then filters through to everything else. Everyone else gets more paranoid to think, oh my God, I best look after over my shoulder.
And that's why his legacy would be that he was never a leader you could respect, because he was a little bitch. He was a guy who didn't go out in front and lead. He was a guy that sat and waited for the other side or the other party to make a move and then reacted. Is there anything else that we need to...
No, I just wanted to say, like you said, Alan J. Pakula, that director, like you said, he's got famously, he's touched a lot of other political and films which more or less changed the time, like he did Kill a Mockingbird as well, didn't he, in Sophie's Choice.
I was reading it. He was a producer, and then he got an opportunity to do some direction. He did a quite a high-profile film called Clute with...
Oh, yeah.
Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland, which I've seen, which is another one that's quite stylish.
Yeah, yeah.
I always think of him as a guy who is a good example of making films in that kind of early 70s sort of period where people were, like Hollywood filmmakers, it was that era when, you know, obviously, I think we've talked about this before, some of your real seriously influential directors started to emerge.
Yeah, yeah.
Scorsese, and it just seems like that 20 or so years of learning how to work with the technology they had then in terms of like cameras getting better,
yeah,
the equipment getting more capable in terms of, you know, all of a sudden you've got the ability to build more complex shots. These people are artists.
Yeah.
These filmmakers are making art. They're not just trying to make films that they're not, it's not just pap, you know? And like, unfortunately today, Hollywood is making a lot of pap.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of really amazing independent work going on.
Yeah.
Probably doesn't surface through the major studios, does it?
No.
And ironically, Redford started the Sundance Festival, didn't he? And
yeah, yeah.
I mean, apart from anything else, like, who, for a studio to actually back this film, yeah, would you see that happening now? You know, yeah, back this. You know what I mean? You can't see him actually wanting to do it.
Yeah, it's like they don't want to take the risk, isn't it? It's like, it's very similar to the, I've just done one on Psycho with Ken, and that was self-funded by Alfred Hitchcock because the studio again was a bit worried about touching something that's so risque, so he had to shoot it in a different way, black and white. Obviously trying to get under the X rating because he wanted it to be in his own style.
I would say there's a slight difference there because I don't see Hitchcock as somebody that wanted to do anything other than make entertainment. It was just that I don't think he made Psycho thinking he was going to be educating the masses, or I just want to find a slightly different flavour of entertainment. And if that means that we get to see some tits, then, you know.
Yeah, just do it. Did you also find about in the 70s is his outside shots? Outside shots in a lot of the films in the 70s, like you got French Connection, etc., and they use a hell of a lot of moving onside outside shots rather than sound stages.
French Connection is an incredible film, isn't it? It's a great example, yeah. I mean, presumably, that's budget and technology to some extent.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got equipment that we can use.
Outside, robust enough.
We've got the license to do it.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, they had outside shots in the 50s, you know. Think of all those cowboy films. I mean, they went out and...
Yeah, but it's predominantly in a setting area which they controlled. And even if it was the 1950s, you know, Doris Day films, you can tell you that that's still on a soundstage and he's sat in a car having to go back and forth where the movement of the car's behind.
And presumably as well, to some extent, the desire to go into areas that people hadn't talked about before. Like you say, I mean, American urban scenarios, like projects, you know, the
creation,
the poor
parts
of a city, you know, The studios wouldn't have, you know, that. Just a Jimmy Cagney gangster film, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Been a studio set, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Some alleyway, you know, you're supposed to think of that as like the mean streets, you know, and then you go to the actual film Mean Streets.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's
on location. Yeah.
Yeah, it's on location. It's in a real grimy, grubby city. And yeah, I think it's interesting though, because I don't think you get that sense that Washington is that grimy, grubby place.
No.
Most of the settings of all the President's Men are pretty swish, really, other than this.
I think there's probably a need for that within the film because it's showing how grand everything is. Everything where they go is the grand buildings or how big it is, and I think it also shows like, doesn't matter how big and how beautiful everything looks, there's this corruption and this foundation which is being rocked by these two men.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the amount of money washing around. The first check that they find, $25,000 Dahlberg.
Yeah.
And at today's prices, that's about $200,000.
Wow.
So when they're talking to the bookkeeper from Creep, key scene in the film later on, and she talks about $6 million arrived in cash.
$6 million.
And you're like, okay, so that's more like
70 million now or something.
Yeah, 50 million or something in cash. And you look at the campaign funding for the current American presidential candidates, and it'll be
billions, won't it?
It'll be high sort of 80s, 90s millions of dollars that they'll be collecting and spending.
Wow.
Thanks. That is the nature of American politics. It's very money driven.
100%. It's not really changed, has it? It's still corruption. We just hope that there is more great news reporting what goes on in the future, even though I very much doubt it, seeing how everyone thinks they're a fucking news person at the moment, and more or less set sales except politics, which is a shame.
I think there's still a lot of great investigative journalism going on.
Yeah.
I think it is definitely an interesting one to work out. What can I trust in terms of an outlet? Who do I trust? I mean, I still basically trust the BBC. I think, we need to be really, in this country, really be grateful that our main source of news is probably still a body that doesn't get paid for by a private business.
Yeah, yeah.
And doesn't directly get paid for by the government, because in either case, you would probably trust it less, sadly speaking. We've all seen what it's like where the news agencies are controlled by the government. China, North Korea,
yeah,
Russia, all good examples of where it's like, oh, no, thank you. If you think about the USA, the audiences are bigger, the territory's bigger. It's not, there's a reason why their favorite newspapers are only in cities. They don't have a national press in the same way that we.
No, that's true.
And if you think about it, Watergate was broken by the local desk at the Washington Post. It was a local news story.
Yeah.
Because it was a local break-in. If that national party office had been in New York, or it had been in Philadelphia, or it had been in Los Angeles,
yeah,
the Washington Post would have never gone anywhere near it.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true, yeah.
In London, you cover London, but you also cover the whole country.
Yeah.
It's a slightly easier thing, and hence we've got a national press and we've got national news, but they haven't got national news in America, really, in the same way.
So, we come to the end of the pod, and it's been brilliant. We looked into the film, but as a good piece, this is a historical film with historical content, which you should, if you've not seen it, you should go out and learn it and watch it. It's well worth it. Thank you very much for joining, Simon. And before we leave, I always ask you, what song would accompany the film at the end?
Extensive thought went into this. I spent many, many long hours racking my brains trying to think of the perfect track, and ended up coming up with an album track from a brilliant band, Rage Against the Machine. And I thought this was quite an appropriate one. Take the Power Back.
Take the Power Back.
From their classic first album.
Nice one, Simon. Thank you very much, mate. Thank you for joining me again.
Right, you are, Clifford.
Thank you, mate.
For the next one. Thanks a lot, listeners. Over and out. Teaches us to redirect so-called facts of fraud. He wants to elect your pleasure bound down in
puncture the structure of life. Don't be our minds and attempt to hold us back. We've got to take it back. Holes in the spirit causing tears and fears. One sided stories for years and years and years. I'm inferior, ghost inferior. Yeah, you need to check the interior of the system. Who cares about only one culture and that? So we gotta take the power back. To break it down. But the lesson plan he can't recall. The student's eyes don't perceive the lies bouncing off every fucking wall. Closure is well kept. I guess he fears playing the fool. The place the students sit and listen to that bullshit that he'd learned in school. Europe ain't my rope to swing on. Can't learn a thing from it. Yeah, we hang from it. Gotta get it. Quick weatherman. I'm like a motherfucking weatherman. Expose and close the doors on those who try. The strike over and mangle the truth. Cause the circle of hatred continues unless we react. We gotta take the power back.
No more lies.
No more lies.